very warm welcome on behalf of the Mosaic Rooms to this debate called Balancing Acts, Performing Nationalism and Other Scripts. You are sitting in the exhibition Pattern Recognition, which I had the pleasure to curate. It is the 9th edition of the Young Artist of the Year Award, which is a biannual competition for Palestinian artists up to the age of 30, wherever they are residing. And it was actually working with the artist over a course of 5 months that the idea for this panel surfaced somehow. And it really made me think, working with young artists and the proposals that we got as a jury, because it's an open call, it's a competition, how issues of nationalism are rehearsed, performed, scripted in contemporary art, not only Palestinian art, but also art larger in the Arab world, but also in cases of conflict, where there are certain expectations about nationalism and how artists script these ideas within their work. So I was, when working with the artist, but also before, quite struck how many Palestinian artists, young artists, but I know this is also the case for artists who have also more established careers, how they felt sandwiched somehow between, on the one hand, a pressure from their own societies to carry out a certain message of Palestinianness and a certain narrative, and on the other hand, also a pressure from Western institutions, what kind of art Palestinian art actually is and what kind of art they actually should be making. Now that is, of course, a lot of pressure on artists, and it's something that I feel many Arab artists have to deal with, and it's not a pressure their European or Western peers have on their shoulders. So I thought it's interesting to speak about these ideas, but also how nationalism and certain ways of enacting nationalism can sometimes be emancipatory tools, but sometimes also be limiting and constricting in terms of what visual vocabularies artists have at their disposals or think they have at their disposals. And I think it's important that when we speak about nationalism, we speak about it in terms of the plural, in terms of isms. And when we speak of nationalism as a resistance, we also have to speak of that in terms of plurals, what type of resistance, and by whom, and who actually owns them or has access to them. So, again, going back to these categorizations that often Arab artists are find themselves in, I'm very encouraged to see that the last few years, particularly in the West, there has been more of an openness towards curating contemporary art from the Arab world. And if you look, I think 10 years ago, there would be broadly, and I'm of course making a blatant generalization now, but there would be broadly three categories that of subjects that artists from the region would somehow fall into, and that would be popular would be the veil, conflict, and Islam. And if somehow as an Arab artist you would not somehow script that within your work, you would not really comply to this idea of Arabness, this Western idea of Arabness. Of course, this has to do with funding and opportunities, and I think we also need to take the broader picture into account when we speak of contemporary art, because there's, of course, this thing as the market and catering to certain expectations. I remember in 2011, after the Arab uprisings, there was a huge interest in revolutionary art. And if you were not catering as an Egyptian or Tunisian or Syrian artist to that particular strand of practice, your work was not always interesting enough, or it would not fit in certain exhibitions. So this is something we need to take into account when we think about how these things circulate or how they move within contemporary art field, the contemporary art field. I think it's extremely timely to speak about nationalism wherever we are, painfully facing Trump and Brexit, and also the rise of right-wing nationalist movements in the Netherlands, France, and Germany, and elsewhere. It's also interesting to see how nationalism there is casted as something that actually critiques establishment politics. Mm-hmm. Obviously, it's a nationalism that's based on exclusion, it's xenophobic, it is discriminatory in every way. And then I think it's interesting to look at the Middle East, where nationalism there is used to serve often the hegemony. So it's interesting if we look at these dynamics. That as the context that we actually are having this debate here tonight. I know, understand that these are very sensitive and complex topics. And I think art is a sphere where we can talk about these topics in a way that also open them up, where an imaginary is possible, where multiple subjectivities are possible, where in other spheres they are not. And I think this is something that we have to embrace and we have to insist on for as long as we can, because who knows. Well, So tonight I'm joined by my expert panel, and I'm very happy that you're here, because I do think that the three of you will cover these topics from different perspectives. To my left is Lina Khatib, who is the head of the Middle East and North Africa program at the think tank Chatham House, and before she was director at the Carnegie Institute in Beirut. Lina has written also a lot on the image and visual representation in the Arab world, and your nighttime job is actually managing one of the oldest Lebanese heavy metal groups.
The oldest heavy metal groups
in Lebanon, Blacqueue. To Lina's left is Larissa Sansour. Larissa was born in Jerusalem, now lives and works in London. She's an artist, and in her work addresses the Palestinian context by using a multitude of mediums, but a lot of video, and she will share her work with us. Larissa's work really straddles this interesting gray zone that also somehow I tried to encapsulate in this exhibition between fact and fiction, and how the Palestinian context addresses that. Larissa has exhibited widely internationally at many biennials, festivals, and exhibitions. And she will also speak about her personal experience of being a Palestinian artist and dealing with the different types of nationalisms and how that relates to her work. To Larissa's left is Sandra Nutt. Sandra is based in Berlin and is a researcher, curator, and lecturer, predominantly researching dramaturgy in performing arts and choreography. And Sandra really works on the body. That's her subject. Bodies in conflict, bodies in opposition, and the non-Western body as well. So the format of tonight is that each panelist will have about 10 minutes of presentation, we'll then have a discussion, and then we'll open up to the floor. So Lina, if you would like to start?
Yeah, absolutely. Let's wake this up. How do I do that? Oh, okay, great. Right, it's wonderful. Let's see what happens with this. Okay.
That can stay for now.
Right, well, first of all, it's a pleasure to be back doing this. I was saying to Nat, people who saw my bio, you know, as part of this talk must have been wondering why is someone who works on policy showing up to talk about this. But I have been obsessed with studying visual representations in and about the Middle East for a very long time, for a decade and a half, basically. And what I wanted to do today is follow on from what Nat has talked about and deconstruct, I guess, the motivations behind the survival of certain motifs, as we can call them, when it comes to representations of national identity, when it comes to the Arab world in particular. Why am I talking about about national identity as a motif? I actually borrow this term from the work of a former colleague of mine called Akil Awan. He defines motif as the way someone feels they have to perform in order to be considered, between quotation marks, authentic. So it's a performance of identity when I'm talking about motif. And national identity is a motif. And as Nat said, there are certain motifs that seem to have become very dominant when it comes to representations of nationalism in the Arab world. So we can think about the different motivations behind this. One of them is, of course, you mentioned hegemony. It's the hegemony of the collective experience. It's not just about history, it's not just collective history or collective memory, because it can also be a collective ongoing experience, especially in areas of conflict. I did a big study of Lebanese cinema that I published a book about 9 years ago. And what was interesting for me was to look at feature films from Lebanon and realize that every single one, from the start of the Lebanese Civil War in 1975 until the date that I basically published the book, which was 2008, all these feature films were about the Civil War in one way or another. And I started thinking, why are Lebanese filmmakers obsessed with representing the Civil War? And I felt that the war had started in a way reproducing itself as a hegemonic element of national identity in Lebanon. And I say hegemonic because Lebanese society had kind of embraced it and also continuously took part in reproducing this notion almost automatically. It's as if it became a sense of duty to represent the Civil War. And what I will say about this kind of motif is that it has become an example of what I call, between quotation marks, expected familiarity. Mm-hmm. You know, it's the familiar that you expect to perform in order to be considered, between quotation marks, authentic. Of course, Nat also mentioned the issue of funding and appealing to the West, so to speak. And this is another motivation, which is appealing to the outside world, mainly in the West. And here, very often, using this motif is actually a very conscious and deliberate reproduction in order to appeal to the West's interest in the exotic and fit the mold of what the West might be expecting from the so-called East. And artists, in a way, start performing this sense of self whose exoticism looks familiar. So it's another example of expected familiarity. Nat also mentioned the example of the veil, you know, and women being used in a very particular way in order to represent the East. And I will say the seeds were planted a long time ago, and this is one example of them, the paintings of La Croix about the harem. The notion of the woman that's not just veiled but also exposed at the same time. You know, you have this interesting play. Some of you may be familiar with the... Oops, how do I do this? How do you click on a Mac?
maybe...
It's the next one. Oh.
This one?
Yeah. Oh, it's just that. Yeah. These Algerian postcards that were sent during the days of French colonialism in Algeria. Some of them were photographs, some of them were paintings over photographs, but basically they were of local women photographed by the French colonialists to send back home. A lot of the soldiers who were in Algeria, who were French, used to send these postcards back home. And this has carried through into the present time. So if we look at the work of an artist like Shireen Nashat, you will see a very similar motif. Now, of course, here we have to kind of take a step back and say that the intended meaning actually has shifted. The postcards that you saw and the La Croix are about very simple objectification of these women in the East. What Shireen Nashat is trying to do is expose, in a way, the East's responsibility in this objectification. So this is meant to be a critique. But what I find problematic is that the visual motif is very similar and has become a means of access to the Western art arena through representing expected familiarity. And this becomes a way to perform authenticity, you know, in the Western arena. And so I find this, as I said, problematic, because the survival of this visual motif is what makes even notions of resistance that are using the same visual motif end up doing the opposite. Because the veil has become so taken for granted as a visual symbol to represent the East or women of the East, incidents like this, which is the poster that the same artist who created the whole poster for Obama created recently as a protest against Donald Trump, to me has ended up doing the opposite, has ended up using the same problematic notion of a woman from the East instead of, you know, I mean, I tweeted something about this and I said, if you want to represent Islam, why not use a crescent as a motif? Why the veil? You know, The veil is not equivalent to Islam. So this is why I have a bit of a problem with, the work of Shireen Nashat that I displayed earlier, because this motif has, in a way, taken a life of its own and become just accepted, normalized as authentic. But, of course, artists don't just do this, and that's the beauty of art. There is a dominance of national symbols. When it comes to Palestine, I'm sure we're all familiar with the national symbols that are dominant, symbols about resistance, symbols about suffering. And they exist in many familiar works of art from Palestine. A while ago, many years ago, 10 years ago, I believe, a book was published called The Subjective Atlas of Palestine, which I think you can get in the bookshop outside. And in this book, there are all kinds of different pieces of visual representations of Palestinian identity, and this is one of them. So here, if you look at the different images, you will see many familiar ones. You know, you will see a rifle, a grenade, handcuffs, barbed wire in the shape of a Palestinian map, a Molotov cocktail, you know, all these symbols that have become associated with, Palestine, basically, as an identity. But what's also interesting about this is that these images, as you can see, are also mixed with images stemming from the everyday experience of being Palestinian. Now, of course, resistance and oppression, sadly, are part of the everyday experience of being Palestinian. But in this, they are also mixed with images of a cooking pot, images, you know, of coffee, images from the banal, the everyday. And I think the fact that the symbols of resistance are included among symbols of the banal, like cooking and coffee, alerts us to the constructed nature of national identity metaphors. So it draws your attention, you know, that these are constructed. They are not to be taken for granted. It's also about how struggle has become normalized as part of being Palestinian. So again, you could reverse it. You could say struggle has become as normal as drinking coffee in the morning. So again, it depends on your reading. It's not one reading. But the issue is when normalization of any metaphor becomes a default state, it becomes, in a way, the starting point for many artists who want to represent their national identity and therefore find that, in a way, they have to start with these symbols. So, now that I've deconstructed the different motivations and reasons behind why certain symbols and motifs keep kind of appearing and reappearing, I want to turn to saying that what we should pay attention to is not just the notions themselves. In the context of Palestine, we're talking about the return, resistance, you know, these notions that have visual representation, but also the mode in which they are represented. And what I find interesting here is art that is subversive. It's art that invokes the familiar, but through a different medium or a different genre. And as an example of this, I'm going to play you a clip from basically my lovely band. So I want you to listen and also to look. Let's see if we can make this bigger. And how do I press play that way? Okay. Okay,
Okay, get the lights back on, thank you.
So those of you who are familiar with Middle Eastern folklore music might have recognized the sample. Can I ask how many people recognize the song sampled? Very few people, okay. Yeah, those of you who don't won't recognize it. But basically, what you heard him sing in Arabic is a very, very, very famous piece of Middle Eastern folklore, Arab folklore, Al Ain Mulayitain. It's played in weddings, it's played in parties, it's played even in demonstrations. It gets everyone dancing dabke in general. It's a very, very, very recognizable piece of Middle Eastern folklore. And obviously, as you could see, this is a heavy metal band. And so here we have a celebration of Middle Eastern culture, but through a genre that is definitely not typically associated with this culture. In general, Al Ain Mulayitain is not performed by, you know, men with long hair and tattoos headbanging. And it's very interesting for me to look at reactions to this kind of subversion. When I play this clip to people, a lot of people's reaction, from those who are familiar with the original, the reaction is close to accusations of sacrilege. You know, some people have gone as far as say, "What have you done to the song? How dare you?" You know? And so, what I will say is, this kind of subversion is about recognizing that the notion of authenticity needs problematizing and should not be taken for granted. You know, as you said, national identity and nationalism are not one thing. But interestingly, at least in the case of what we're doing with the band, it's not just about the East, it's also about the West. And so here we're using Middle Eastern percussion, tabla, and it's not just a way to infuse a Western genre, which is heavy metal, with Middle Eastern elements. The idea is also to make these elements themselves sound heavy, you know, in heavy metal. And so this is about asserting presence in the West as much as it's about celebrating the culture of the East, but without fixing it within an authenticity framework. And so what I will say in conclusion is, I'm a big fan of subversion, because subversive art both celebrates belonging but also frees the artist from the shackles of expected familiarity. Thank you.
Thank you. And now, Sandra, if you would like to take the floor.
Yeah, actually, that fits quite well. If you can't hear, if I should speak up loud, you give me a sign. So actually, it fits quite well, but I think both of you addressed already things that I will look to from the point of view of contemporary performing arts and choreography in the Arab world, but also like generally speaking. And just as a very short context to the notes that I'm going to share, but actually, I mean, no need to say that the body, no, that performativity, performance, literally speaking, has been like at the center of the revolutionary events that we kind of witnessed from 2010-11 onwards. A little bit in what not described for the visual arts and performing arts equally, like at the same time, like that was just a lot of festivals, conferences, commissions, residency programs, and so on, like mushrooming in Europe for like choreographers and dancers, or contemporary choreographers and dancers from the Arab world. And here we already face a small problem, because this idea of contemporaneity in dance and like choreography is really a very Western concept, no? It has been developed like with the 20th century onwards in Europe and the United States. That means that already initially, like many choreographers and dancers or performing artists from Arab countries are kind of confronted, not only, it's not only about discourses and rhetorics, it's really like physically speaking with a vocabulary. So you go in a rehearsal studio and you put a movement language on your body which stems from a completely different culture. And this is a really, really big thing. There's a huge inscription talking about scripts. So all these things kind of happened and mushroomed, so there was more visibility and with best intentions sometimes. I don't say that there was no positive effect on this, but at the same time, I see also like now talking from the perspective of a Western curator, there was not a lot of knowledge, because other than even a visual arts field, I think a performing arts field, there was even less knowledge about what happened in the Arab countries. And many people would have said there is not a lot, because if you open a dictionary on dance, there is basically almost no Arab artists. And of course, this is not because there is none, but it's just because of like very normative and hegemonic kind of canons. So what happened is that while this gave more visibility to these artists, at the same time, I think you could really see the topic of nationalism coming back. And not only because border politics were restrictive and people who had the chance and opportunity to show their work and develop and to go into residency couldn't travel because they didn't get any visa for instance, or Arab artists couldn't kind of work together, they had to go to Europe and work in European context because they could not meet amongst themselves and work or have residence in their countries. So that's one thing, but there was also a lot of kind of, let's say, curatorial and institutional politics playing. And before talking about that, I wanted maybe in relation to the body point to two, let's say, I would say major dynamics that we need to look at, in my opinion, if we talk about nationalism and the body. And the first thing is the idea of embodiment, you know, of ephemerality of the body. So this pair of nationalism and the body in dance and performance art is not new at all. This is something that has been existing, like, I mean, in the 19th and late in the 20th century onwards, even if we look at, we had dances that incorporated kind of naturalistic movements, authenticity, you know, all these kind of things. We had like Roots and Dennis, these very early kind of modern dances who kind of embodied Orientalist kind of idea. So this is something very old. And of course, it has very often been a super essentialist idea, like linking a healthy, a human, a pure, and you recognize the rhetorics, no, body to ideas of nationalism. And this is not only in socialism, communism, I mean, being German, the Nazi reference is evident. So that is something that has been very, very strong. And the interesting thing is, again, that it's an ambivalent dynamic, as Lina also pointed out. So yes, there is all this ideology and this loadedness and also the manipulation and abuse of these concepts. And at the same time, it has been at the center of really very important kind of reform movements in dance and performing arts. So it's not only black and white, but it's really kind of a circulation that we need to understand. So, yes, expectations, of course. It's a lot about expectations when national denomination kind of becomes crucial to localize a certain aesthetic. And I think that's something. And what happens then also is that artists are reduced to their capacities to represent. And I think you illustrated that. The second thing I wanted to point to is a tension that is not exclusive, but I think easy to observe in several Arab countries, which is a kind of link or a fundamental tension between an individual and a collective body. And like working with like dancers and choreographers from Arab countries, this is something that is really at the center. These identity politics are really at the center of the work, you know, like exactly as you say, you know, kind of what is acceptable to represent, what's kind of traditionally transferred. And again, Depke is only one reference, but I just remind us that even Depke has been subject to different national and nationalistic movements, Arab Palestinians, but also Zionist movements. So, you know, it has been really like operationalized, manipulated by very different kind of ways. So this idea of becoming collective as a dancing body on stage, but at the same time, of course, as an artist seeking or wishing for individual expression, now I think that is something that is a very difficult thing to balance if we speak about balancing acts. Just a footnote on that, like most recently, there is an initiative that started in 2015, which is called Mintala. I don't know if you heard about that, which is kind of different artists from different Arab countries, choreographers, dancers, that work on creating what they call, and I quote them, a pan-Arab company. And this is also interesting that in, you know, in the artists' ideas themselves, this idea of pan-Arab, and of course we think about pan-Arab nationalism, comes back. Maybe we can talk about that later on. And at the same time, like I know that Farah Saleh has been showing work here, I think, a Palestinian choreographer and dancer, and she has lately researched, I think she started in 2014, a long-term research on collective gestures, no, on kind of Palestinian collective gestures, and so that's another example. So for me, this idea of, or this struggle to kind of emancipate, but at the same time to be really kind of interwoven in these kind of gestures and body pictures, and at the same time, of course, corresponding to logics or to kind of expectations from the West. And I mean, this is just, I say it was a little bit a cynical note, but I mean, you know, when the first thing you put on your program leaflet is the nationality of, you know, to really indicate that he or she is Syrian or, you know, Palestinian or Tunisian or whatsoever, I mean, that are all these labeling strategies that I want to get to. Speaking about subversion, like Farah, I think what she did in her work, and this is ongoing and it had different formats, so she did a kind of interactive choreography movement installation, but she also has stage performances. What she does is that she kind of really keeps up this notion of Palestinian gesture or Palestinian collective gesture, but by the way, she implements choreographic strategies, that is interactivity and others. She again, she insists on the fact that these collective gestures, again, as Lina pointed out, are constructed, are aestheticized, are rehearsed, and I think the rehearsal of nationality is something that, and the kind of the rehearsal on your body, you know, changing and adapting your appearance depending on nationality. This is something that, again, we learn from everyday life, but which is very present in stage work as well. So maybe just as a remark from a perspective as a curator, I want to mention a situation that happened 2 weeks ago in New York. And mentioning this situation is not to say that my point here is not to smash this situation. I think it happened to all of us and it's happening all the time. But there has been a performing arts program very well known, which is American Realness, and it's a collaboration with MoMA New York. And in this framework, or within this framework, Latifa Labisi, a Morocco-born French artist, showed a performance. And the point, the solo is not a new work, it's, I don't know, 5-6 years old. So what happens is that she's mostly nude in the performance and she wears a kind of headdress from Native American women, a sacred headdress. So she showed the performance and that was a huge scandal and it was also a huge fight. And I don't want to talk about Latifa's work here because I don't want to talk in her place, and this is also not my issue. But as a curator, what happened is the curators apologized, the institution apologized, everyone apologized, but no one kind of seriously entered into a dialogue with Latifa. And why I'm bringing it up in this discussion on nationalism is that the main point of controversy was like, is she a Moroccan artist or is she a French artist? What does that mean? So as a Moroccan, that is, as an Arab artist, she has the experience of being, I simplify, of course, no? You can read this up on the internet, it's all over. But I just want to say, as a Moroccan artist, you have the authenticity, you have the experience of being colonized, so it's a different story than if we read her as a French artist. I found that quite astonishing, to be honest. And then at the same time, wondering, as a curator, and I would kind of think this, if we could talk about that. So we speak a lot about complicity and engagement, but where is the point where you disengage, you know, where complicity turns like from the side of a curator or an institution, where it turns into soft humanism or this kind of washing out, whitewashing dynamics. So that was just an example. So to sum it up, yes, who is allowed to speak and for whom? Who can perform what, and how do we kind of not only because of course this idea of inscription is at the center of the idea of choreography, you know, cafeing, writing into space by movement and in time. So the thing is, how do not only our bodies become objects of nationalism, you know, in the sense that we kind of rehearse this and we adapt it, but how do we also kind of contribute to and help to maintain certain nationalist narratives through performing us, through the way we use gestures, we use movements, and so on. So, for me, like looking at the field again of performing arts, the question of nationalism is a question of structural violence. It's a question that has taken on really environmental qualities. So there is a big issue about censorship and self-censorship, but this is, I think, important. It has the two dynamics, and it's also something that expands, it extends in time and space, you know, so it's not so visible. It has an impact, as we heard from Nina, on the imaginary and on imagination. So what do you even, or not said in the beginning, what do you even dare to imagine on stage, you know, where, how can I get rid of certain things as an artist? Yeah, so maybe I just leave it here. And
thank you so much. So, Larissa, I think it's also interesting to speak about the Palestinian context of nationalism. How does nationalism behave when you are stateless, when you don't have a nation, when you have been dispossessed? So all of that comes into play also in Larissa's work.
Thanks, Nat. I feel that everything has been discussed kind of academically, and I agree with everything. But the problem is that I come from a place that has been, you know, under occupation, and I grew up in Bethlehem. I was born in Jerusalem, so I grew up with all these, the symbolism that kind of, you know, all the representations of resistance. So for a long, long time in my life, the last thing I wanted to see was a dabke or a falafel or a hummus or. So I distanced myself completely from that, and even when I was doing my degree in art in New York, I was working with abstraction and Russian constructivism. It's almost like representation was something that was scary for me. I wanted to distance myself from that. But then political events happened, and then you are part of that context, so it becomes very alienating to be doing something that is just not really relating to what, to where you come from or what you speak about on a daily basis. And at that time, I was when I started really working with the Palestinian issue, I was living in New York, and the siege in Bethlehem happened, and that's where I'm from. So I constantly was talking to my relatives and friends, and whatever it was they were telling me was very different from the media. Kind of launching pad is a bit different because I'm kind of stuck between a wall and a hard place. Mm-hmm. So I have this kind of nationalism as a resistance movement, but at the same time, I'm given this vocabulary that I don't know what to do with. You know, all the you know the keys, the right of return, the olive tree, the cactus, and but somehow I kind of I feel that in relation to what you were saying, Lina, and how the hijab is used as though it is a critique of that, but then it becomes part of that vocabulary. So what I actually try to do with my work is kind of flip the game and kind of subvert the context in which you find those symbols in. So instead of kind of not using those symbols, use them, but in a completely different context to kind of shift the meaning of them. So this is I'm going to show a film that, a 1 minute clip from a film I made in 2009. So I need the whole page, the whole. So this is the first one. So if you just hit play. So the footsteps that you see at the end of the film, it's not very clear here, but they're actually the kefiye patterns on as footprints. And that started a whole kind of trajectory into the rest of my work, where I was using this almost as a constant that goes in my work, the kefiye symbol. It started serving as a... almost like a Palestinian DNA, and the way I was trying to kind of tackle this obsession with everything that comes with Palestinian symbolism and the resistance movement was to try to understand why the symbolism came to be, and I think it very much has to do with the fact that we are an identity in trauma, and that's the fact that it is identity is we're always trying to kind of find a place to belong to. We need to reaffirm the fact that we exist or we belong to that land. The fact that we have a huge military power that's trying to erase the Palestinian people from the face of the earth makes it very kind of necessary to just keep on insisting that the symbolism really matters, but then this symbolism from its repetition kind of loses any, you know, whatever it signified doesn't really almost relate to anything real. It just becomes kind of almost more abstract than the thing it's trying to represent. So it was very interesting for me how fiction and reality really work together. And I'm going to show another clip from a film I made in 2010 called Nation State, and you see the entire Palestinian state finally being granted a huge skyscraper where everybody can live there. There are no checkpoints. You can travel from one floor to another. Each floor is a different city. And the symbolism in that is so over the top that every kind of floor was reenacted to look like a Palestinian city. And the minus one floor, it houses the Dead Sea. On another floor, there's Bethlehem, Jerusalem. It is a place where Palestinians can live happily, but yet they're surrounded by the Israeli wall still. I'm going to show a little bit, a minute from the film. So among other things in this film, you see the Palestinian flag, the key, me watering an olive tree on the Bethlehem floor, Palestinian embroidery, all sorts of stuff. It's just packed with that. But it's packed in this skyscraper that almost functions like a museum. So they kind of feel like artifacts rather than things that are organic or that they have any meaning whatsoever. And this brought on, I think, my kind of inspiration for the next project that I was working on, and the last film that I made called In the Future They Ate from the Finest Porcelain. And part of Nation State, you see the keffiyeh pattern on porcelain, and I eat from these plates. And the film ends with me looking out and seeing that Jerusalem, actually, the real Jerusalem is outside that skyscraper, and the whole skyscraper is surrounded by the Israeli wall. So these plates became kind of like, again, a symbol of resistance. But they still remained in the fictional realm. And I wanted to make a project where I would kind of bridge that fiction into the real. So I took these porcelain plates that really belong to these fictional, this fictional skyscraper, and I took them and buried them in various parts of Palestine and Israel. And the idea was for these plates to be buried in the ground for future archaeologists to find. So it plays on various things. It's not just, the fact that you are kind of breaking the cliches of how you really think about your national identity, but it also is very much about how other national identities get created, and it's very much a comment on Israel and how myth plays a big part in the constitution of that nationalism. So I'll show a little bit here. 1 minute, I think 2 minutes and a half from this film. It's just kind of maybe it doesn't completely like fit in what we're saying, but it very much is how symbolism gets used, and also in this film, although it's started as a film, actually it ended up also being a performance piece where I did bury the porcelain plates in various parts of Palestine. So it's kind of a reactivation of dead symbols, where they actually start mattering because they are buried in the ground, and certain places where they're buried, they're illegal, according to Israel. So they become more real than what they really represent. So accompanying this project, and based on one of the bombs that you see in the film falling on various parts of Palestine, opening and spreading these porcelain everywhere for future archaeologists to find, I decided to make my own bombs to house coordinates where I actually buried this porcelain. So this plate that you see is actually being buried in the Dead Sea. This one is in Haifa, and this one is in Acre. And so these bombs look exactly like the bombs in the film, and they're based on the Russian nuclear bomb. So that also is another kind of significance, but maybe I won't go into that now. But these plates that you see in the bomb, and you see it here, they have the coordinates of where exactly each deposit of this porcelain is being made. And this project was shown at the mosaic rooms. This is a picture of how they were displayed back in the summer, which was a great show. But that's it. Thanks.
I was really interested, Lina, when you were speaking about how Blacum actually mashes up they're belonging to the West and they're belonging to the East, because it also reminded me of actually the history of modernist Arab art that's so much linked to nationalist independence movements, where many of these artists were actually educated in France or in Italy and elsewhere, and then went back to their countries of origins, and in the 1930s, 40s, 50s, brought their training predominantly as Western sculptors and painters, but mashed that up with, specifically in Iraq, Mesopotamian artwork, Assyrian, Babylonian motifs, visual motifs, and in Egypt the same thing, where they would go back to pharaonic styles, and actually like that, reappropriate that in order to found those nationalist movements. So it's very interesting how appropriation becomes an act of resistance somehow. It's very dramatic, this.
Appropriation. Yeah.
Perfect timing. And I think, Larissa, that's exactly what you do in your work. You defamiliarize certain symbols of belonging in order to reappropriate them again. So I was wondering, like, where politically, maybe you, Lina, you see are these fields where of appropriation, actually, and maybe Sandra, where do you feel you know the body can reappropriate, actually?
Okay, well, I'd like to tell everybody a little bit more about the band, because this will help.
She remains a manager, huh?
Yeah. No, not for that reason, but because it expands on what this idea of belonging. So, if anybody knows anything about the music scene in a place like Lebanon, or actually Arab world in general, heavy metal is not exactly liked, it's not quite accepted, it's actually banned sometimes, different governments arrest musicians or even fans of heavy metal, including my own band. the lead singer was jailed twice just because he's a heavy metal artist. And so, in many ways, I know that, of course, in every country almost there is an underground music scene, but in the Middle East, this goes beyond just being underground. This goes to the dimension of exile and not belonging and being considered as something alien to society and as far as being rejected. So these artists exist in Lebanon and don't feel that society wants them there, but they very much want to celebrate the culture. So there is this tension and the struggle for belonging inside. And then we go outside, we come to Europe, and again, in general, with heavy metal, there is a certain expectation. And we're trying to say, actually, even in a place like the Middle East, there is heavy metal, and it doesn't have to sound like the heavy metal you get from a European country. I mean, yes, it's the same genre, but we've made it our own. We've infused it with a new instrument, which is the tabla, used in a way, basically not in this clip, but in other songs, riffing like a guitar, which is not how you normally play this thing, and it's not normally used. So again, in a way, it's asserting belonging in both these spheres. So you're appropriating a genre from the West, you're appropriating a folklore from the East, but you're blending them and making them their own in order to fight for existence. And actually, you know the story, right now the band is kind of torn because they know they can't really stay in Lebanon, but at the same time, it's very difficult to exist in the West, so they're in this liminal state, I suppose. So I think, in a way, what you saw is just a small visual representation of the struggle that they have in their everyday life. And by the way, when I was preparing this, I mean, I didn't originally want to include my band. I didn't even think about it. And then I was thinking about your work. And what struck me was the idea of genre, you know, using science fiction as a genre to represent Palestinian nationalism and identity, which for me is very similar to the generic subversion that we saw. So I thought, this is actually quite interesting. Anyway, I'll stop there.
It's very true, and it's also appropriating that genre as that it can be Palestinian and popular culture, and actually also making that your own, I think, is very much what you do in your work. But Sandra, I was interested to hear from you, maybe since we're speaking about appropriation, where can the body in the Middle East or at large still appropriate?
I mean, if I now look at the artist's work, I mean, like, let's say working with dancers and choreographers and so on, I think there's two major things. One is similar to what Lina pointed out, or what we saw in Larissa's work, is that they, I mean, basically, like, for instance, in Palestine, there is the real Ramallah, but there is no like permanent, you know, like high level training in dance or something like this. So it doesn't exist. So what happens is that either a kind of artist, mostly from the West, come into Palestine, give workshops, like temporary kind of education, perhaps of movements, techniques, and so on, or the artists travel and again, mostly for short periods, go somewhere and get training, come back, and then, and this is a specific feature, then immediately they become the teachers. So there's a whole thing about community. So you just learn something and you're immediately a teacher. So but what many of them describe, and there is a lot of different strategies though, is that they kind of reappropriate this kind of Western language. And of course, again, now I'm essentializing, there is also nothing like the Western language, but just for the sake of speaking here. So they take like the movements, the techniques, the things they have learned, and they change the rhythms, they put in some music from Palestinian culture in this case. So it's a little bit the same thing. So they take on the genre and they kind of make it their own. And that goes to the point that they, of course, also think about how can they have different vocabulary, you know? Like not using this idea of contemporary dance, but maybe, I mean, there is some, you know, like thinking about pan-Arab dance. You know, we can talk about these ideas, but or about danse du jour, you know, dance of the day, you know, kind of trying to reformulate these ideas. So that's one thing. The other thing is that I think what many of the performing artists, like they work with bodies in Arab countries, do at the moment, and what I find very interesting, that they try to understand the constructedness, I think you talked about that, of nationality in like movement and gesture. So from the perspective of a choreographer or from the perspective of a dancer. So how exactly is discipline used in representing or rehearsing and inscribing, embodying nationalism? How is like gestures used? How is breath used? You know, all these kind of classical tools that you have as a performing artist or a dancer, trying to re-understand. So what is important, what I want to get to, is that mostly it's not the radical change. So like visually, we often stay in very traditional language if we look at what is presented on stage. But I think it's more about introducing more like a kind of hesitation, you know, like a kind of suspension that points to how things are constructed and what is the ideologies behind. Again, if you expect quick change, this is not what is happening, you know, and this is also why it's still problematic to kind of, I mean, many artists encounters when they are invited to Western festivals, they become like as the spokesperson of a bigger cause of the Syrian and so on. Horrible things happening, but I think this is the two.
Yeah. But it's really interesting you're mentioning that, because that's also the question I wanted to pose to Larissa, because there's a lot of complicating of nationalism in your work, but also often you are curated as a Palestinian artist, where you are not only the individual artist Larissa Sansour, but you become like a nationalist representation. Mm-hmm. You become a symbol, whether you want it or not, for Palestine somehow. And this is often also how these artists are curated within exhibitions, but it's also often how you are seen, that you become a spokesperson somehow for your society, whether you like or not. And I wanted to ask about your personal experiences, maybe the bad ones. I know there is a very bad one. that you
just might one.
Well, choose whichever you like. How that also complicates to navigate your position within the art world, and you know, what kind of pressures does it actually put on you?
I don't know. I think it took me a long time to get to where I am now, because I kind of didn't want to do work about hijab that had nothing to do with what I wanted to say. And at the same time, as I said, that the vocabulary was just not really available for me to find a different way of talking about it. one of the things that I found, that, I mean, it wasn't just a pressure from where, say, my responsibility as a Palestinian to kind of like deliver a certain piece of knowledge to the rest of the world, because I live outside of Palestine, therefore I know what people think about them, and therefore I kind of want to also find a different way of talking about them. But at the same time, it's also navigating, you know, Western curators who boxed me in a very, very strange, you know, place. For example, I was criticized by a curator, not criticized, but said that your work is great, but we can't fit it in a Middle Eastern show because it's too slick and it's too it's overproduced. And we want like handheld cameras and, you know, just like documentaries about how bad it is there. It's just okay. So yeah, you could have saved me lots of money, because I mean that's exactly what I'm doing. I'm critiquing that kind of cliche of, you know, of handling anything that to do with the Middle East. And I do very highly produced work. I spend like most of my time fundraising because I want to break that cliche. So for me, that if you don't see that as a curator, then you're not understanding the whole point of the work. So that is a problem. And I think the incident that you're referring to is my Lacoste scandal.
Yeah, but also your work with Orit, I think, is a good example.
Yeah.
Because where both of you become national representations that are not always accepted.
So, yeah, I worked with Orit Asheri, who's originally from Israel but based in London. So we did a book that was about two artists that kind of get contaminated by a virus, and they become superheroes and they go to save Palestine. And the whole book was really just very much kind of addressing the problematics of normalization and how our whole collaboration will be seen by the world. And it just, you know, discussed at length. But what we discovered is that people just from the Middle East, they refused to even look at the book because it was within because I worked with an Israeli artist. So that's normalization. Even if the book is critiquing that or what the problematics of it. And in the West, it was also not really like very welcome because it was very critical of Israel. So, and which is just then becomes like, we often were told it's too one-sided. So in the end, we have a whole project that we spent 2 years on that really just was short-lived. It's just like
had no audience.
So that is very problematic, I think. And I was very sad to actually be kind of almost excluded from a lot of shows and programs, specifically in the Middle East, because people were kind of saying, "This Larissa works with an Israeli. Just, you know, don't, you know, deal with her. So I'm contaminated." And it's really tough for a Palestinian who's actually, it's very, very hard to, you know, work with an Israeli, try to come up, really kind of study your psychology, the Israeli psychology, Palestinian psychology, and understand what's at stake here. So it wasn't pleasant for me at all, neither was it for Orit. But it was a very enriching experience, but at the same time, the fact that it was dismissed as, oh, this... This thing is just a project not to look at because it fits into the normalization.
I'm aware that we're running a bit late, so I think now is maybe a good time to open up to the floor if there are any questions or comments at this stage.
I have a question about curation and collection in the Arab world itself, because you've talked a lot about expected familiarity from the point of view of Western audiences. What about Arab audiences themselves, as we see more exhibitions in the Gulf States, particularly in more collectors there? What kind of motifs, if any, do you feel that they accept?
Shall I take that one? I'm not sure if the Gulf is a good example of what's happening in the Arab world. Yes, the Gulf has the budget, they have the money, but they're not necessarily a center of production. The center of productions are still traditionally Palestine, Lebanon, Egypt, and also used to be Syria up to the civil war. So what the Gulf has is, yes, money, collectors, and a way of performing soft diplomacy through culture. Mm. So you will, and I think the different Emirates do this in a different way. I think Abu Dhabi does it by actually importing huge Western institutions like the Guggenheim and like the Louvre, which performs a very specific type of cultural diplomacy. I think Dubai does it through the art market, where the last 10 years you have seen a mushrooming of a gallery scene, and you have a very stable and strong art fair there. And Sharjah does it through the biennial. So it's very different there. In terms of performing, so, and I have to say, the artists that both Sharjah and Dubai and Abu Dhabi show, they're mostly not Emirati-based artists. These are artists that come from the region and have either made their home in the Emirates, or there are artists who still live in the region. I think you can count on both hands the Emirati artists that are being shown in the Emirates. It's a very nascent scene, the indigenous scene, I would say. Saying that, I think that in Beirut, for example, there is, the last few years, and this is something very new, there is a growth of institutions, of museums and collectors. I think that's somehow also a reaction to what's happening to the Gulf. But I also think that has to do with money, you know, where now if you are a collector or you are a private person of means, you will somehow found your own initiative and your own museum. So it has to do also with the performativity of wealth somehow, and wherein arts and culture also becomes a commodity. I mean, you know, something we're facing all over the world, how the luxury art market and the luxury market somehow come together. I think what's happening with nationalism in the Gulf, definitely there are red lines, what you can and what you cannot do. I think a good example was that in the Gulf, after the uprisings in 2011, they were extremely nervous. I don't know why they were nervous, but they were nervous that some of it could rub off on the Gulf. So you saw like huge move towards censorship and cutting down certain projects. I remember, the Sharjah Biennial is a great example. Jack Persikian, the director at the time, was fired because in public space there was a project by Mustafa Benfodil which showed mannequins who were wearing football t-shirts. There was 11 of them, and they had like Quranic inscriptions, but also inscriptions of rape. Mm-hmm. So that was like a reason to fire Jack Persikian. Other artists had like small protests in protest of the Emiratis actually going into Bahrain. So their people were arrested. I know of a friend of mine, Eli Doumit, who is a Lebanese gallerist in Dubai, who brought, I think it was 2013, an Egyptian, a show that was focusing on the Egyptian image during the uprisings. So it was as well photojournalism, as activist, as artistic work, like really a mélange of that. It was shown first in Essen in Germany. And what usually happens in the Gulf is that there will be very targeted censorship. But here, the whole show was closed down, even I think before he opened, as a national security risk. So these are, and what I think is interesting, what's happening in the Gulf is that usually people are very nervous about religion and nudity or erotics, but it, whatever gets censored is always political. You know, I think that's an interesting change maybe that we see, yeah? Because I think many of the artists will self-censor for the previous themes, but these political censoring I think is interesting. Lebanon, Egypt, I think now after Sisi almost nothing is possible. We see an enormous crackdown on arts institutions, the townhouse being one of them. I've heard William Wells, the director, is in the States and cannot go back. We've also seen an enormous escape of artists after 2011, artists having to flee because they were graffiti artists but were condemned or accused of being Muslim Brotherhood and had to leave. So I think I've actually gone way beyond your question, but I think, yeah, we really need to be aware of that context and how regionally and geographically the geopolitics work, and how, in Lebanon it's very different to what was happening in the Gulf to what is happening in Egypt as well.
Very stimulating talks and images, but a question really or observation is there is a film, a silent movie being shown downstairs, which I watched as I was waiting for the event to start, and it shows a number of, it's set in Palestine, I take it, and it shows a number of Palestinians waiting at the bus stop, and then there are some coaches with Western pilgrims or tourists getting off and making their way. But I noticed many of the people, Western women, waiting for bus stops were using their iPhones. And so what I thought was, here's a nation which is denied self-determination, which is denied independence, but it has the benefits of globalization, iPhones. It reminds me of Tony Blair, I think, when he was boasting as a special envoy in the Middle East, the great success. What, how many mobile phones have been sold in occupied Palestine? So it's this kind of contrast between, the reality of being denied basic dignity, nationhood, and this globalizing Moloch, really. So I was wondering if there's
anything. Well, I mean, the artist is sitting amongst us. Ruba is here, so I think she's in the best position to comment.
I don't have an answer for that, but it's interesting that you took it to a totally different place. It's really interesting to see how people react to your work, and it wasn't a silent, it wasn't supposed to be a silent movie, but it was about, the theme was about the return, and it was for me an attempt to collect the fragmented realities of Palestinians, of different realities of Palestinians.
Right.
So that was the main idea of it. I'm not going to talk a lot about it, but it's totally, you took it to a different place, which I really respect.
Different reverberations.
Yes.
Definitely is happening now as well with Syria and Iraq. I guess, why do you think, it's kind of a bit of a vague question, but why art in general, in the broader sense, is used to kind of summon this sense of shared humanity almost, that it's almost set up on a pedestal of, oh look, you know, now they're protesting and they're using graffiti and street art, so therefore they're worthy of some kind of, in the way that the media uses art. I guess, how do you think, why is art given that kind of role, that fear, to kind of cultivate that sense of political solidarity, or is that fear? Maybe not.
If I understand your question correctly, are you, I'll try to rephrase, so correct me if I'm wrong. So you're actually asking why art is placed in a privileged position by the media to convey a certain message? Is that what you're asking?
I think some, if we think about the way art was used as mushrooming after 2011, I guess why was art kind of privileged in that sense? Mm.
I don't ever think that art is so privileged.
No,
but
then
it's interesting
also
that
what kind of media, no? I mean, like, if you look in the media in the Arab countries, I mean, especially if it comes to body-based, but not only, also visual arts, it's like, I don't think so at all.
But I find it a very interesting question. Just,
mm-hmm.
You feel that the media privileged art in a way?
Yeah, I felt it privileged art in conveying certain narratives about certain parts of the Middle East that were kind of discussed or represented in the media in a very particular way otherwise. So let's say Iraq, you know, seen as a site of destruction, and then, oh, but, you know, there's some street art, and therefore it's kind of not, they're not just victims, but, you know, maybe kind of along this kind of teleological side of progress.
Mm-hmm.
That's
an interesting question, But how are we going to answer it?
I don't know. I think I don't. Privileging, I think it's interesting. I think indeed we need to see which type of media, and I think if the Western media does it. Of course, there's an interest in you know, human interest stories and showing a different side to a story other than only carnage and war and dead bodies. I think, I mean, what we spoke about earlier, that art does open up an imaginary and, yes, a humanity, and it places subjects in different roles, you know, that otherwise, okay, in the Middle East, how many roles are available, either the victim or the terrorist, right? And that's also something that you and your work try to subvert and actually create a multitude of roles. And yes, okay, it's sexy, you know? I mean, I think as we saw how the revolutions worked as well for Western institutions, I mean, they actually approached what happened like the media, you know? War is sexy, you know? It attracts people somehow. Revolution is sexy. Street art is sexy. But that's street art, and I think, you know, graffiti has some subversion to it. I wonder if a similar thing would be for a conceptual piece of art, you know,
exactly.
That would be much more complicated other than, I mean, I see the value of street art in Egypt was immense because it was a way of reappropriating the city and the streets that were not really accessible to citizens up to that point. But yeah, I wonder whether... It's completely accurate, your observation.
I think it concerns, as you say, a specific kind of art.
Mm-hmm.
And I think Larissa pointed it out super clearly, you know, like, and I can rephrase this for performing arts field. Every, like, artists that wanted to work on, I don't know, conceptual work, more composed work, you know, out of these narratives. No way. So again, what happened is that, and again, we have a small field. So it was the same 5 or 6 choreographers touring whole Europe and the US as the Arab representatives. And I don't blame these artists as artists, no? I mean, this is fair enough, and they are there with the work. But I just want to say there was no way to come up and say, I want to do a piece in silence as a, you know, or there would be, the silence because suffering and death and stuff, but maybe it was not about that at all. And I know many artists who kind of, were just not able to get into any, not even on stage, and like, let's not talk about media. So I think it's a very relevant question, but we really need to see where we locate it.
You talked about, well, you touched upon and talked about subversive art and its value. Of course, that's subversion in art has been used for a long time by women artists, for example, any underclass who tries to emerge out of, you know, out of the pit, so to speak. And I was kind of really found what, you know, Larissa said about the work that she did with Orit really interesting, because it was just that, you know, it was a taboo subject that got censored,
So, and how, I think actually think that artists have to walk up, they have to take on that now. And of course it's very difficult because it means that, you know, that you're going to get a lot of criticism, especially with Israel. It's very difficult to get away with anything because you're just going to be accused of being anti-Semitic and blah, blah, blah. Well, that is not going to be the case, but the value in what you did, the work that you did that was not at the time valued, I'm sure will be in the future. It will be seen as, and I haven't seen the work, and I'd love to see it. But the issue of, you know, silencing artists who work with, you know, political issues is something that's always been around, and it's not going to go away very quick. But I think we just have to keep on, you know, challenging those authorities that try to put us down. So I hope to see that piece of work.
Thank you.
And I'm sure that it will emerge as, you know, as a really important and defining moment at some point.
Thank you. I hope so too.
Thank you.
Is there another question, someone?
It's a question really for you, Nina. I'm a bit wary about soft power, obviously. And I noticed the word radicalisation being used a lot, and the possibility of art and artists coming in addressing that. And I was just wondering, in your role at Chatham House, whether art comes into the discussion and to what degree it's instrumentalised potentially to build trust or appease or to do any number of things. It might be, or whether that's...
I can tell you with confidence that I'm a fluke at Chatham House. There are over 200 people who work at Chatham House, and I'm the only one with an arts background. And sadly, art doesn't feature at all in our policy discussions. I mean, I was saying to Nat, you know, normally I spend most of my time talking about Syria and hard politics and... But I agree with you when it comes to soft power, yes. And maybe this relates in some ways to the question asked about the media. Very cynically, I think, focusing on art and culture is a way for policymakers in the West to show that they are doing something concrete in the region that will give them high visibility. But that on the ground, let's face it, I mean, I have obviously a lot of respect for artists, but let's face it, art alone will not transform political systems and will not drive revolutions. It's a tool, it's a component, it's important, but it's not sufficient. And therefore, focusing on soft power and art and, you know, nice, fluffy, wonderful things is, I think, a cowardly cop-out by many Western governments. Just like, I'm sorry to say, focus on women's rights groups, you know, all these programs that were set up, which I'm not saying are completely without value, but they were framed in a way that actually devalued, you know, what you know, these things had been achieving, you know, because they were used as a tool to polish the image of the West and what it was doing to the region.
So if there are no further questions, then thank you very much for all your contributions, Sandra, Larissa, and Dina, and thank you so much for coming and your engagement.